Narrow Mind with Pastor Gene Cook Jr. Love him or hate him, you're still listening to him.
Welcome back, everyone, to the second hour this morning of our broadcasting. We're going to be covering chapter 6 this morning, in this second hour, of Christopher Hitchens' book, Why God Is Not Great. This is actually part 8 in the series. We've got Paul Menard in the studio, if you are just tuning in with us, and my co-host to my right here, Jonathan Goundry. We're going to continue, and because we're a little bit short on time, we need to finish at 10 a.m. this morning, Pacific Standard Time. We're going to jump right into it. So, Paul, you want to continue with what you have for chapter 6?
Sure. In this chapter, Hitchens, chapter 6 on design arguments, he makes his first attempt to show how theistic proofs can't deliver the goods, how believers don't have good grounds on which to base their beliefs. At least that's how he portrays the argument for design. But the function or role of design arguments need not serve for Christians as some sort of evidential grounding of the Christian belief. Hitchens is stuck in an Enlightenment and evidentialist tradition, and most believers don't use these kinds of arguments as some kind of base from which they build up to belief in God. And in fact, I would argue that Hitchens' entire case against theism simply assumes an outdated religious epistemology, and only works by first assuming that God doesn't exist. But without getting into all of that, which would be religious epistemology and not necessarily design arguments, then for this chapter I'll just mention his critique of his main lines of argument against the design and creation, and then I'll launch my own argument against the reliability of Hitchens' cognitive faculties based on what he admits in this chapter, namely the conjunction of two beliefs, naturalism and evolution. So that's a design argument he doesn't mention, the design of our cognitive faculties, and I'm going to give that design argument against Hitchens while also undermining his critiques of more traditional design arguments. Hitchens gives two types of what he calls, he says design arguments are divided into two types, macro and micro. Macro design arguments refer to the universe and the earth as a whole. Micro refers to specific organisms like you and I particularly, or specific animals. So I'll begin where he does with the macro. I'm going to run through a bunch of his critiques before I get into my design argument against him. On page 77, he claims that both types of design arguments were most famously summarized by Paley. Well, of course, this gives the illustration that he's attacking the argument in its strongest form. But a famous summary is hardly the most cogent or rigorous summary. Those accomplishments might go to the likes of, you know, an Aquinas, Schlesinger, Collins, Dembski, even a Plantinga in regards to design and our cognitive faculties. So the trend continues. Hitchens interacts with no one, and certainly not the best. On page 78, he claims that predation, right, animals, predators killing other animals, supplies evidence against a benevolent designer. But he gives no supporting argument that predation is incomplete or incompatible with goodness, nor does he take into account the fall, if we're going to assign predation to the fall. That's something debatable. But I've also provided arguments against Hitchens that his materialism leads us to eliminate qualia like suffering. Mm-hmm. So with animals suffering, and he's just going to have to eliminate that and just talk about sea fibers firing. He's going to have to talk about meat bags running into other meat bags, and why he thinks that's so evil and horrid and wicked. If he doesn't, why does he think it's wicked then on our worldview? He's going to have to get rid of all of that. And also, he would need to show, if he could show all of that, he would need to show then that these instances of animal suffering, or, you know, when a lion kills an antelope, are gratuitous evils. Because certainly everyone in the atheist world that I know of admits that God's goodness is compatible with evil if he has a morally sufficient reason for it.
Right.
The atheist is going to say, well, but about what about gratuitous evils, evils that you couldn't possibly have a good reason for? So Hitchens needs to show all of this stuff, but he doesn't. On page 79, he asks whether human death should be considered part of the design plan. Well, that seems to be easily refuted by turning to the first couple of pages in Genesis. That we die no more implies that we're not designed than does the fact that my car might rust out. It doesn't imply that my car wasn't designed if it rusts out and falls apart eventually. On page 80, he claims that inhospitable regions in the universe prove that it isn't designed. Okay, well, a universe that is fine-tuned to support life doesn't imply that each and every part of the universe is hospitable to life. That's, you know, absurd an argument as me arguing that a massive biodome built out into the desert isn't designed because humans can't live in the giant fan rooms or inside the furnace in the biodome. You know, or like me taking a car ride with Hitchens and saying, look at how this interior of this car is designed to support, you know, human life. I can roll windows up, but there's still, you know, a source of oxygen in here, and there's these seats, and I'm not dying, and so it's designed, and it supports life, and if Hitchens said that to me, and I grab Hitchens and shove him in the gas tank and say, well, why don't you try living in there?
Yeah.
And he doesn't live, he doesn't make it on our road trip, and he dies, and I could say, well, look, the car wasn't designed because there was the inhospitable zone.
Right.
So
it's an overgeneralization, isn't it? You're taking one facet of creation, which is now under the curse of God, and you're basically saying, therefore, every square inch of Earth is not designed for man.
Right.
It's essentially what he's saying.
Well, I would even say, even if there wasn't a fall, there would be things like volcanoes. I have no problem with a volcano. Why does that, you know, mean God is evil?
Yeah.
So
what about the stars colliding with one another? Or
yeah, and things like that as well. I have no problem with that. And Hitchens just has this odd Pollyanna sort of, you know, happy unicorn view of what Christians think the world is like. That makes up his arguments against macro arguments, and that was it, what I went through. I find it suspicious that he didn't interact with the fine-tuning arguments. Simply put, it has been shown, and it's believed on all sides of the matter here, that the universe and its laws of the nature of life as we know it are such that if there were minuscule changes in the universe, in any number of areas, life would be impossible. Everyone agrees on this, whether they're atheists or Christians. Some examples might be that, for example, orbit, the inclination of orbit. If too great temperature differences on the planet would be too extreme, if it was too less, it would be also too extreme. Axis tilt on the Earth. If greater, surface temperatures would be too great. If less, surface temperatures would be too cold. It would be too hot if greater and colder if not. If less, rotation period of the Earth. If longer, the diurnal temperature differences would be too great. If shorter, atmospheric wind velocities would be would be too great. With stars, the number of stars in the planetary system, if more than one, tidal interactions would disrupt planetary orbit of life support. If less, heat produced would be insufficient for life. Star age, if older, the luminosity of the star would change too quickly. If younger, luminosity would change, would also change too quickly. And there's just, you know, literally dozens of these examples that both, you know, Christians and non-Christian scientists have found out about the world, about how finely tuned it is for life, that if, you know, even one little part out of, you know, 10 to the 60th power of certain things were changed, that life wouldn't survive, or if our the gravitational laws were just slightly off. And he doesn't even interact with that argument, and those arguments have been developed into powerful design arguments. And Robin Collins is perhaps the most lucid and conservative defender of this argument. But one can also look to the works of a pagan and what I call a functional atheist, Paul Davies, for arguments supporting. He has books that are out in Barnes & Noble. You can go get them. And he's not, you know, a Christian. He's not. He doesn't even come out as a full-on theist. He says, I mean, it's some sort of mind or intelligence behind the formation of the universe. But he gives all these arguments as well, and Hitchens doesn't bother to deal with any of them. So moving on now to his micro-arguments. He attacks design arguments for the eye in two ways, on pages 81 through 83. His first attack is simply to quote an excerpt from Michael Shermer, relaying to us a just-so evolutionary story. But as usual, Hitchens fails to cite contrary arguments. Again and again, we're only treated to one side of the story in this, you know, so-called demonstration of free thinking, mm-hmm. you know, at its finest. Anyway, here's his just-so story of the eye, quoting Shermer. Shermer says, evolution also posits that modern organisms should show a variety of structures from simple to complex, reflecting an evolutionary history rather than an instantaneous creation. The human eye, for example, is the result of a long and complex pathway that goes back hundreds of millions of years. Initially, a simple eye spot with a handful of light-sensitive cells that provided information to the organism about an important source of light, it developed into a recessed eye spot, where a small surface indentation filled with light-sensitive cells provided additional data on the direction of light. Then into a deep recession eye spot, where the additional cells at greater depth provide more accurate information about the environment. Then into a pinhole camera eye that is able to focus on an image on the back of a deeply recessed layer of light, light-sensitive cells. Then into a pinhole lens eye that is able to focus on the image. Then into a complex eye in mm-hmm. such modern mammals as humans. Mm-hmm. You know, wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. But, okay, how did it work? Anyone can make up a story like that. I want to know some details. I want to know, you know, how all of this happened via small, gradual, advantageous mutations over millions of years.
I think you're going to need billions of years. I've noticed that a lot of atheists just add on the billions. The more complex some facet of creation is, they'll add on the billions.
Well, they couldn't for this because they would say, you know, life. The life that I started wasn't billions of years old, but yeah, they do add on, you know, more time. The, you know, a frog turning into a prince is a fairy tale, right? But a frog turning into a prince over billions and billions of years—that's reality.
That's reality, concrete reality.
Well, but I want to know, what does it mean to say information was provided? How did that happen? He didn't explain how that happened. When he said it found at one stage it would find out sources of light were quote unquote important. How did that happen?
Mm-hmm.
How did knowing what was important and not happen? And why does this information have to be accurate? What does that matter? Couldn't inaccurate information also yield survival? Just the same, Dr. Sean Pittman responds to the above type just so stories. Quoting Pittman, he says, the question now, of course, is how could such a system evolve gradually? All the pieces must be in place simultaneously. For example, what good would it be for an earthworm that has no eyes to suddenly evolve the protein 11 CIS retinal in a small group or spot of cells on its head? These cells now have the ability to detect photons. But so what? What benefit is that to the earthworm? Now, let's say that somehow these cells develop all the needed protons to activate an electrical charge across the membranes in response to a photon of light striking them. So what? What good is it for them to be able to establish an electrical gradient across the membranes if there is no nervous pathway to the worm's minute brain? Now, what if this pathway did happen to suddenly evolve and change a signal, and such a signal could be sent into the worm's brain? So what? How is the worm going to know what to do with this signal? It would have to learn what the signal means.
Mm-hmm.
Learning and interpretation are very complicated processes involving a great many other proteins and unique systems. Now, the earthworm in one lifetime must evolve the ability to pass on this ability to interpret vision to its offspring. If it does not pass on this ability, the offspring must learn as well, or vision offers no advantage to them. All of these wonderful processes need regulation. No function is beneficial unless it can be regulated, turn off and on. If the light-sensitive cells cannot be turned off, once they are turned on, vision does not occur. This regulatory ability is also very complicated, involving a great many proteins and other molecules, all of which must be in place initially for vision to be beneficial. Now, what if we do not have to explain the origin of the first light-sensitive spot? The evolution of a more complex eyes is simple from that point onward. So we don't have to explain all this stuff that he just went through. We'll just give that. That's a given. Okay, so now with that given, the evolution of a normal eye, that should be simple, right? Mm-hmm. Not exactly. Mm-hmm. Quoting Pittman still, every different component that requires unique proteins doing unique function requires a unique gene in the DNA of that creature. Neither the genes nor the proteins that the creature, that they code or function, or they function alone. The existence of a unique gene or protein means that a unique system of other genes and proteins are evolved in the function. In such a system, the absence of any one of the system's genes, proteins, molecules means that the whole system becomes functionless. So, he doesn't interact with any of this counter-arguments against his just-so story about the eye. Well, Hitchin goes on to back up Shermer by claiming that this process was demonstrated to be able to work by some sophisticated computer models. And just as you'd expect, Hitchens provides no sources. Nevertheless, the fact that an intelligent designer showed how it could all work on a computer hardly removes my confidence that the eye needed a designer. Hitchens' next argument against the eye's design comes from Shermer again. This time he claimed what was an astonishing feature earlier in the book. He says the eye is an astonishing feature. Now it's just a hatchet job. Okay, that's the other argument that these guys always give against design arguments. you know, the eye is so bad. Look at how poorly constructed it is. Well, no doubt Hitchens and Shermer could do better. Perhaps they can make another fancy computer program that shows a better eye. At any rate, intuitive arguments based on our gut feelings about how things should have been aren't good arguments. Okay, so atheists need to get that through your head. When you come here and say, well, he should have done that, that's not good. That's not as good as I would have done it. Those aren't good arguments.
That sounds like truthiness. Yeah.
Well, and you also need to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, let me see you do it then. Make the eye, make the person, come on. Now, this argument, though, fails to take into account trade-offs and compromises that all designers make when designing something. It's also an argument from ignorance. And since we don't know all there is to know about the eye and the visual process, how can he say that it's a bad design? Hitchens and Shermer are also assuming that design arguments, that all things are optimally designed. But this confusion would have been avoided if Hitchens had bothered to familiarize himself with anything. On the other side, for example, Dembski has an entire chapter distilling the myth of optimality in design in his book, The Design Revolution. No one's saying that we're optimal, you know, total perfect, can do everything, you know, perfectly in our design from God. Hitchens then complains in this whole critique of the eye that ospreys, right, these birds, that they have better eyes than we do, and bats have better ears than we do. Well, would Hitchens rather God have made him with bird eyes and bat ears?
I might have been more attractive.
Well, thank you for return to the studio. Actually, it just reminded me a little bit of John Loftus. Right?
It would have gone with his man boobs and his middle section.
Uh-oh.
You'd have to listen to... That's actually a scholarly comment that were taken from a... an article that was posted online today, but you'd have to listen to the last hour in order for that to make sense.
But I was going to say, didn't John Loftus sometimes argue along these lines? That
yes, God, we should have wings.
Yeah, and things like that.
Yeah, so picture Hitchens now. He's made the way God wants him to. So he has bird eyes, osprey eyes, and he has these bat ears, on the sides of his head. Well, that's just silly anyways, because certain organisms are designed to occupy and exploit a certain ecological niche, right? Humans don't need to see fish in the ocean from hundreds of feet away. I mean, this is, again, amateur hour at Hitchens' house. You know, rabbits are faster than us, so would Hitchens like rabbit legs to go along with his bird eyes and his bat ears? You know, just get the maybe throw in some bear claws in there to defend himself. So, you know, also, there's a problem with bird eyes, too. A bird's eye, they're very tightly fitted to their skull, and it's capable of very little movement. And that's why we see birds, they're always seen moving their heads all around, because they're trying to change their visual relationship to something. In most birds, the eyes are placed much nearer to the sides of the heads than humans. Okay, so add that in your picture. Hitchens' eyes are going to be now on the side of his head,
closer
too.
To his bat ears.
Right, right. And in most birds, they are placed much nearer to the side of the head, and what this does is gives them a greater overall field of view, but it greatly reduces their binocular vision. Okay, so binocular vision in humans is about 140 degrees out of a total of 180. The best binocular vision for a bird at all is about 70 degrees. So even if Hitchens got his bird eyes, he would complain. Yeah. Why didn't God give me the binocular like those hominids over there? They get the so Hitchens wants the bird eyes, which are configured in a certain way on the side of the head for fulfilling a certain role. But then he wants the binocular vision. So how's all this going to get done? These things are. What would he want? Would he want to see forever? See through mountains? Would he start complaining about God that he couldn't see? If he could only see 100 yards on a clear day, would he then say, I want to see 101? Or, if he could only see 50 miles on a clear day, well, why not 100 miles? Why not 150? He's always going to have something to complain about because he hates God.
Until God was willing to make him exactly like himself. All-knowing, omniscient, all-seeing. Eventually, that's what he would have to settle for. I mean, that's the only thing that would suffice in his complaint against God.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, God, why didn't you make me exactly like you?
Yeah, but then God doesn't have eyes.
Which is reminiscent of the garden, right?
Yeah.
God doesn't want you to eat the fruit because he knows that you will be like him, knowing good and evil. In other words, he's already assumed the autonomy that's right, the autonomy over his own life, that governance is reserved for God. So he's usurped God's authority, in a sense, in determining for himself what is good and what is evil. But now he wants, and he will want, if you press him, like you said, Paul, he's going to want omniscience and omnipresence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so these critiques against design arguments, they'll never go away, because there's always something they'll say that could have been better.
Mm-hmm.
And why do we get hurt? Why do we get injured? Why do we die? If they never wanted that, then he never wants to fall. There would never have been a fall. There would have never been a need for Jesus,
mm-hmm.
which is the greatest good, right? The greatest love is that a man would lay down his life for his friends.
Right.
So in Hitchens' world, where he thinks is more ethical, in Hitchens' world, the greatest good is never instantiated. Only in a fallen world like this is the greatest good brought about.
And exactly. It's also interesting that Hitchens longs for those things that are going to be reality in the new heavens and the new earth.
Yeah. Well, I don't think we'll have osprey eyes in the new heavens.
No. No sickness. No death.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. No disease.
Well, yeah. He's not. He just mocks at the...
So he's got that in common with the Pentecostals.
Well, he has a lot in common with Pentecostals and fundamentalist Bible interpreters, interpreting everything very literally and...
If it's in the Bible.
Yeah.
Good enough for Paul, it's good enough for me.
On his continuing with his design argument, on page 85, he complains about junk DNA. But as my, vestigial organs and whatnot, the little tail that people are, you know, people are born with.
Like that shallow hell thing?
Yes. That was a little bigger.
Okay.
But
that was an awful scene. Okay.
I'm sorry. That's imprinted in my brain. So.
Uh-oh. Well, in response to the vestigial organs, as my friend Steve Hayes says, this is simply a Darwin of the gaps argument, right? We don't know what survival value it has for today, but it must have had some survival value at some time. So, you know, we'll just plug Darwin in there. It had a reason at some point.
Well, we
don't know what the reason is now.
Yeah,
we don't know what it is now. So it's junk now. That's just an argument from ignorance. On the same page, though, he mentions we have similar DNA with all organisms. But how is that a problem for design? At certain respects, we are similar with those other organisms. Wouldn't we have to need similar DNA? Now, Fitchin says, oh, no, we could all have different DNA and still have those similar roles. Right. So like me, a dog and myself, we both walk and do certain things similarly. And so we both have similar DNA, which, you know, does those physical roles. But Hitchens would say, no, you can all have this wildly different DNA and still fulfill those same roles or functions. Since God's all-powerful, then he could just do it, just zap his wand and do things like that. This, again, taking Hitchens wasn't in that chair. He wasn't in the big boy chair. He didn't make those decisions. He doesn't know how it is to design a world and the creation and what's the best way to go about doing it. And when you come with the different compromises you have to make and trade-offs. Now Hitchens, though, if God took Hitchens up on this and made everyone with just wildly fantastic DNA, which I'm sure Hitchens would say, see, that's proof of evolution. You know, it's all so wild and different. But Hitchens would again complain against God. Remember last hour with his Occam's razor, he would say, "Well, God should have just used, you know, a repeating occurrent some strands of DNA,
right.
And it would have been more economic and simple. And he just wasted all these extra DNA. That's not very a true designer would have done it as simple as he could. So it's just again a lose-lose with Hitchens. He just has an axe to grind." With God, there's no any way on his argument. He'll make up a new one if it gets refuted. If the things were done the way he would want it to.
Bottom line is, doesn't matter how well you present God and how he's worthy of worship and prayers and adoration, he's always going to find a problem. He's always going to have a beef with God, if you will.
Because Hitchens is a God hater. He doesn't want to believe. He doesn't have rational arguments. That's what we've seen time and time again. He has no rational reason to reject God. He hates him, and he is trying to justify his excuse or his rejection with these horrible arguments.
Yeah, it's so sad to see. Really, really sad.
And it's sad to see people calling this guy to come debate in Las Vegas for them as some champion.
Yeah, the guy.
These are laughable
arguments.
On page 86, he gives Francis Crick a free pass for positing panspermia. You know, the idea that aliens or a comet or whatever came by and inseminated our planet with life, because you have to explain how it got here somehow because it looks so designed. Well, but he doesn't yell at him for violating Occam's razor. You know, why need the aliens? Just chance did it with natural selection. If Hitchens claims that you need a more complex theory to account for everything, right? If he goes, we just can't account for it. We need a more complex theory. That ties into what I was saying on Occam's razor last hour. If reality really is more complex, then you don't go with the simpler theory. On page 90, Hitchens claims that since Genesis doesn't mention every living creature, then Genesis was man-made, right? It makes sense, doesn't it? Because Moses, the dinosaurs were around before Moses, and Moses didn't have a microscope and couldn't see bacteria. So that's why he didn't mention the dinosaurs and germs, because he didn't know about them. So that's why they're not in Genesis. Well, of course, this misses the fact that the garden was a smaller subset of all creation, and it's technically a garden in Eden. There's no reason to suppose that Adam would have known every single animal that God created, and animals even outside the garden. Secondly, there are animals that they knew that existed, they knew animals existed that weren't mentioned explicitly by name in Genesis. So he can't account for this data. And his claim that the Dominion mandate is man-made since bacteria rules us fails to take into account the command of Dominion was made pre-fall. First off, so he doesn't know what bacteria was like then, mm-hmm. or how it worked then, and so he's outside of his inductive range. His remark about Adam not controlling bacteria anyways, because he's reading Dominion in the certain way that Adam had to have like a whip and whipped these germs and stuff and
he made yogurt
into submission. Yeah. Hitchens' remark is about as cogent as if I objected to the idea that a king controlled his people. I would say no. He doesn't really control all his people because he can't control the bowel movements of an infant. Okay, so he's obviously reading Rule Creation in some ultra literalist sense, right. Straight from Left Behind, you know, novels. We're dealing. Remember, guys, that we're dealing and we're treated to the exegesis of Genesis 1 from a guy who learned it when he was a 9-year-old in his Bible study class from Mrs.
Right.
Watts.
And you know, I always make reference to this guy. I'm going to do it once more with Klein in his work, The Kingdom Prologue. There he argues that the opening 11 chapters of Genesis is exactly that. It's a prologue to get to the Mosaic Covenant and the exodus of God's people out of Egypt. So the book in its genre is not about, I want to explain
right,
scientifically.
Scientific analysis of creation.
It's a prologue to the Abrahamic covenant, followed by the rescue of God's people.
And that's true, and that's been pointed out, though, too. I mean, not to knock on Klein or anything, but tons of people have pointed that out.
Yes.
That Genesis isn't meant to be some scientific, you know, analysis of everything, listing every single type and animal. Whatever. I mean, if you were to list every single kind of animal and all the germs, you know, how big would our Bibles be? And then you would have Hitchens complaining about that. Look at this revelation he gave us. We got to sit here. I mean, he doesn't even want to read, you know, the generations. Imagine reading every single animal.
You know how heavy those Bibles would be?
Yeah. So
they would be heavier than a Mormon triplet.
Yeah.
Which is a... Have you seen those books that the Mormons carry on? The JW's got them now, too.
Mm-mm.
The JW came into my house the other day, and he had this huge Bible, man. It looked like the triplet version of the Book of Mormon, the Doctrines and Covenants, and the Pearl of Great Price. And they've now got the New World Translation combined with the commentary for the New World Translation. So it's huge, man. It's about three times the size of a regular Bible.
And I think we're just scratching the surface.
This would be much
so
bigger.
Hitchens wants...
Again, he would need
like a set of encyclopedias.
Put in his little wagon.
Yeah, it goes back to omniscience. He would need like an exhaustive, absolute detailed presentation.
Yeah, but the point is, if he got that, he wouldn't like it. He'd say, "Look at this. This is pointless. What do you need to read? You know, 500,000 pages on every single kind of animal that there is." And
obviously,
then also,
it's man-made,
if
right.
it really was every single, I mean, we can keep going with all this stuff. If it really was every single animal, whatever that ever existed. You know that there are animals right now that we don't know about that exist. Well, Hitchens would mock the Bible. Oh, look at this. It mentions the shugga-bugga down in the animal down in the ocean. We don't know what that is.
We've never seen that.
Yeah, we've never seen that. So Hitchens would say, no. We need to list every single place where they are. Coordinates, you know, longitude, latitude, so we could go and verify God. And this guy is just ridiculous. I'm going to skip the rest of the points I made on his arguments against design.
I thought the shugga-bugga lived in the desert.
Yeah. No.
I thought it was Scotland. Sounds like Scotland. Loch Ness, you know, an off-breed of the Loch Ness.
Nessie.
Yeah, he should have mentioned
which
that.
Might exist, right? Yeah. The Loch Ness.
Behemoth.
There you go.
And I had some other comments on his design arguments, but I'm going to skip that and get into the my design argument against him. The design argument that undercuts Hitchens' anti-design argument that I'll be giving is known in the literature as the evolutionary argument against naturalism. It was developed by Alvin Plantinga. It was first posed in his Warrant and Proper Function book and later revised in his Warranted Christian Belief book. Possibly his most robust statement of the argument was in his paper called Naturalism Defeated. Naturalism Defeated, though, is also the title of a book where various philosophers subject Plantinga's argument to critical scrutiny, followed by a response to each of the contributors from Plantinga. Since that book, there have been various articles and discussions surrounding the argument. And a highlight here would be Troy Nunley's doctoral dissertation defending Plantinga's argument against almost all criticisms up to that point. It was written in 2006. It's still available online as well. Most recently, however, is the latest book in the Blackwell debate series where Plantinga and atheist Michael Tooley debate the existence of God. Plantinga's argument against naturalism and evolution play a prominent role in that debate as well. Not only that, there are hundreds and hundreds of pages dealing with the specific argument alone, but there's also hundreds and hundreds of pages of literature involving Plantinga's epistemological program in general, which is helpful in understanding the argument that we'll be discussing. There's also sub-literature on notions like defeaters, and that play a prominent role in the argument. Okay, so obviously there's a lot going on here, and we don't have the time to obviously go over everything I've just mentioned, so I'm just going to be giving a skeleton of this argument, but I think the nuts and bolts approach is sufficient to undermine Hitchens, and I highly doubt Hitchens is familiar with any of this and would have no clue on how to respond. At any rate, it shows the incompetence of his book that this is just yet another big flashing neon sign for the superiority of the Christian worldview over his that he misses in his devastating critique of Christianity. Okay, so the evolutionary argument against naturalism. We begin with the notion of reliable cognitive faculties. A cognitive faculty is the faculty that produces beliefs based upon memory, perception, and reason, and it's reliable if a great deal of its deliverances are true. But given the story offered to us by naturalistic evolution, that is, the belief that there is no designer who has a goal or purpose in the makeup of his creatures, and that all life evolved according to neo-Darwinian assumptions, where this means that they arose via a process of random mutation together with the rigid law of natural selection, such that beneficial mutations, okay, that means beneficial means mutations that help the organism survive, are passed on in the genes onto the next generation. So fitness-enhancing traits are the goal. That is to say, if any purpose could be attributed to this process, which is doubtful, talk of purpose, but the purpose would simply be the survival of the genes, which obviously entail the survival of the gene machine, us. According to this process, there is some doubt as to whether the production of reliable cognitive faculties, that is, the cognitive faculties aimed at the production of true beliefs, should be expected. And this doubt was expressed by Charles Darwin himself. Darwin says, "With me, the horror doubt always arises whether the convictions of a man's mind, which has been developed from the mind of lower animals, are of any value or at all trustworthy. Would anyone trust the convictions of a monkey's mind if there were any convictions in such a mind?" That survival and not true beliefs is the principal function of any system was also made clear by a limited materialist, Patricia Churchland. She wrote, quote, "Boiled down to its essentials, a nervous system that enables the organism to succeed in feeding, fleeing, fighting, and reproducing, the principal chore of the nervous system is to get the body parts where they should be in order that the organism may survive. Improvements in their sensio-motor control confer an evolutionary advantage. A fancier style of repeating, of representing, is advantageous so long as it's geared to the organism's way of life and enhances the organism's chances for survival. Truth, whatever that is, takes the hindmost." An atheist materialist, Richard Rorty, expresses this same basic tenet of naturalistic evolution when he says, quote, "The idea that one species of organism is, unlike all others, orientated not just toward its own uncreated prosperity, but towards truth, is as un-Darwinian as the idea that every human being has a built-in moral compass, a conscience that swings free of both social history and individual luck." And just one more quote, atheist David Livingstone Smith writes that, quote, "The human brain did not evolve primarily to discover truth, like any other organ, it evolved to maximize the reproductive success of its owner, unquote. Okay, so it seems that across the board, these top-notch evolutionary naturalists are claiming that evolution is only concerned with adaptive behavior. Natural selection doesn't care what you believe. It cares how you behave. Okay? And if you behave in such a way that your genes are well represented in future generations, then that behavior will be selected. If our belief, though, is appropriately related to our behavior, then the belief would also be selected. Okay? But since we are here, we know for sure, again, on this evolutionary story, we know for sure since we're here that our behavior is at least adapted. And so given what these thinkers have stated, then it might be taken that the probability that our cognitive faculties are reliable, and I defined that earlier, given naturalism and this picture of evolution is rather low. Perhaps this is what they are claiming implicitly or explicitly in the quotes that I mentioned just earlier. And this seems right, doesn't it? Natural selection seems concerned with behavior and only belief where it's appropriately related to successful behavior. And so if adaptive behavior guarantees or makes likely reliable cognitive faculties, then their probability of the reliability of their faculties on naturalism and evolution would be high, right? If those reliable beliefs were guaranteed given to come along with successful behavior, then it would be high. But if not, the probability would be low. For example, if behavior is not caused or governed by belief, then beliefs would be invisible to the whole process. So if my beliefs don't cause or govern my behavior, natural selection doesn't care about it. It's invisible to it. If the relationship between belief and behavior then seems very important, seems key, the relationship between belief and behavior. Our having survived means our cognitive faculties are reliable only so far that it would be unlikely that creatures like us could have fitness-enhancing could behave in fitness-enhancing ways but have mostly false beliefs. So the claim that the evolutionist is going to make, that Hitchens would make, is that, no, that we survived shows that our cognitive faculties are reliable, only has any force whatsoever if the claim that we couldn't have also had adaptive behavior with false beliefs is supported. So how are they going to support that claim? To determine this, we should look at the relationship between belief and behavior. Okay, so at this point now in the argument, we would ask the naturalists to think about not ourselves, but creatures a lot like us, who arose in identical ways to us, according to naturalism and evolution. It was unguided by God. So what would the probability then that they had reliable cognitive faculties on this naturalistic evolutionary story? What's the probability for them? Well, there seems to be four mutually exclusive and jointly exhaustive possibilities of the relationship between belief and behavior. The first one is epiphenomenalism. This simply means that their behavior is not caused by their beliefs. Belief doesn't play a causal role in behavior. Other things like organic conditions and sensory stimulation and neural activity does. That's what plays a role in causing behavior, adaptive behavior. Okay, this is a popular position among evolutionary biologists and more than a few philosophers of mind. But on this view, beliefs are invisible to the whole process of natural selection. Natural selection cares a whit about them. They do not enter into the causal nexus and so do not matter to behavior that has survival value. On this view, then, the probability that our cognitive faculties would be reliable, or that these creatures that we're talking about would be reliable, seems low. Another possibility is called semantic epiphenomenalism. This position would state that beliefs have causal efficacy with respect to behavior, but not in virtue of their content, the content of the belief. This means that physical operations of the belief, like neural firing patterns, are what enter into the causal chain leading to behavior. So the belief has two different kinds of properties, neurophysiological and electrochemical properties on the one hand. Okay, these consist of your rate of fire of neurons, the connection between them, the property. Then the other property would be called semantic properties. This includes the content of belief. The content is simply the proposition entertained by a belief. Right. For example, the proposition that I am here in Gene's studio. That's the propositional content of my belief. Other semantical properties are truth and falsehood, belief entailment, etc. So on this view, the content of belief plays no role whatsoever, just the physical properties of it. So the content is called semantic epiphenomenalism. And again, it would look low on this view because the content, truth, doesn't get involved into the causal process. And so it would be invisible to evolution again.
Right.
The third view is that beliefs are both causally efficacious, both in virtue of content and their physical properties, but they're maladaptive. These creatures would then be better off without these beliefs because they're maladaptive. Okay, so obviously we can move on with this point because the probability that a reliable cognitive faculties would be reliable would be low on this view. The last view that our hypothetical creatures have is that beliefs are causally efficacious in virtue of physical makeup and content, and also adaptive. Okay, so belief content causes their behavior, and the behavior is adaptive now. Would this probability of reliable faculties on this view, would that be high? Well, it's not as high as you might initially think. That's because if behavior is caused by belief, it's also caused by desires, fears, suspicions, doubt, etc. But for the adaptive, for any adaptive action, there seems to be a multitude of belief-desire combinations. For example, say we have in our imaginary world a prehistoric hominid named Gene. Okay, so Gene is approached by a hungry saber-toothed tiger. It seems reasonable to suppose that fleeing is the most reasonable adaptive behavior.
Tiger.
But you could
run.
You could
run.
You can have
run.
Any number of belief desire pairs. I don't know if this being knows how to talk yet though. So you could have any number of belief desire pairs. For example, Gene might desire to lose weight, and so think that the tiger is a reoccurring hallucination, and so he vows to take it as a signal to begin running in the opposite direction. Or Gene might desire to be eaten by the tiger, but form the belief that this tiger before him will not do the job, and so he always runs away looking for another prospect. Or suppose that Gene thinks it's cute and cuddly, and so desires to pet it, but believes that...
I go with that one, by the way.
He believes that to pet it, the best way to pet it is to run away from it. Okay, so we could go on and on with these stories. The point is that that all of them are adaptive, but false beliefs. So the belief, the content enters into the causal chain, it's adaptive, but they're false. A response is that the false belief-desire combos may be adaptive in certain instances, but won't work if we look at all of Gene's beliefs in all types of situations. How could it be that all of them could be this messed up? But here we only need to look at belief systems then. For example, I view everything as a creature that God created. And I think that all things should be done for the glory of God. I suppose Hitchens might claim that these beliefs are false, you know, given what we've read in his book. Yet men like Dan Dennett have argued that my religious beliefs have survival value. Okay, so when I view something, I say, that's a creature of God. Or I say, I'm going to do this to the glory of God. That belief is false, then, on Hitchens' view. Others like David Livingstone Smith, an atheist, he has argued that we have, in multiple places, we deceive ourselves about the world around us. And it's an evolutionary advantage, this massive self-deception we're engaged in. And we do it in large-scale ways. Or suppose that creatures evolved using language in a Russellian way, Bertrand Russell way, where all sentences are of the form, they would look like this. That such and such is a such and such. Well, suppose then that they formed beliefs that everything was a spirit or a witch. So that they would say, according to their language and the way they resolve, that witch fork is made of witch metal. Okay, so it looks as if there's multitudinous ways creatures in this scenario could have evolved and had adaptive yet false beliefs, even large scale. But another problem arises. We can reduce the above four ways of belief and behavior is involved down to two. Cases where content is evolved and where it's not. Where content is not involved, we noted that the reliability of cognitive faculties would be low. And here's another problem. Given materialism, how does one escape the claim that content doesn't enter into the causal nexus. I made arguments to this effect a few weeks ago when we just talked about his pig chapter, chapter 3, and naturalism and philosophy of mind, and gave arguments for how the content doesn't get involved into the causal nexus. One can also add the insights of Victor Reppert's argument from reason to bolster the claim that content doesn't get involved here. Thus, it looks like the probability of semantic epiphenomenalism on naturalism and evolution is high. So it's a high probability that belief content would not get involved in the causal nexus on evolution. And if that's high, then again, according to the argument, it makes the reliability of our cognitive faculties low. So it looks like the probability of reliable faculties for these creatures, given that they arose by naturalistic evolution, is rather low. And if the probability is low specified to them, then by parity of reasoning, see, we were just dealing with another group of organisms, so the evolutionist didn't have to think about himself. Now we reason by parity and say, you granted that it would be low for these guys, and since we are virtually the same and we arose by the same way, it would be low for us. They're in the same position. But say that all this probability calculus is too hard to figure out. We say, well, we just don't know what the probability is, whether it's a 0.3 or a 0.4 or a 0.2. We don't know any of that. It's just inscrutable. We can't figure it out. Okay, so that's another option. But here we would also obtain a defeater. To have no clue about the origin or purpose of our cognitive faculties would give us a reason to doubt if they're reliable. If the probability that we're in the matrix right now is inscrutable for us, then we have a defeater for our beliefs. If I was seriously said, I just don't know if I'm in the matrix or not right now, I can't figure it out either way, then I have a defeater for my beliefs. Same with if I were a victim of a Cartesian demon or a victim of an Alpha Centauri alien scientist imposing, you know, cognitive experiments on me and trying to see how much fun he had when he caused cognitive disaster in my life. If I said, I just don't know if that's happening right now, it's inscrutable to me. So this out, if you say, well, I won't say that it's low, it's inscrutable. It's definitely not high, and I'd like to see the argument for that. But so it looks like we have a defeater for our cognitive faculties given evolution. So by holding evolution and giving up God and his design, again, we're on the design chapter, for our cognitive faculties, again, since you have no need for that hypothesis, Mr. Hitchens, you gave him up, well, then you obtain what's called the defeater, or a reason to doubt your belief that your cognitive faculties have as their purpose the production of true beliefs. And it follows from there that you have a defeater for your belief that God is not great.
Amen to that.
Well, thanks, Paul.
That was good.
Yeah, that's. I'm gonna have to go back and listen to this again and let it sink in and chew on it a little bit. Some deep stuff. But we appreciate all the time and energy you put into this so far, and we look forward to the continuation of this series next week, folks. That's all for today. Look for the shows to be posted sometime during the week. We've got four of them that we'll be posting. Be sure and subscribe to the Narrow Mind podcast. That way those shows will be delivered to you free of charge when they are made available. That's it for today. We'll see you next time. Be sure and go to church tomorrow and worship God, the triune God, the only true God of this world.